Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Crisis is certainly the worst that I have seen in my career. Martin Feldstein, a 69-year-old Harvard economist and member of Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, told a World Tourism Conference in Brazil. The evidence simply doesn't support the conclusion that the United States is on its way to a sustained recovery, said the academic, who also served as an advisor under former presidents Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. He added that Europe's economy is equally bad, if not worse, than in the U.S., and Japan has been hit even harder. While some U.S. observers and media in recent weeks have struck an optimistic tone on the back of a rebound in the stock market and positive results from big U.S. banks, Feldstein said that was temporary because the bad news far outweighed the good. He stressed that a one-time rise in GDP due to the stimulus package implemented by Obama's administration was being extrapolated across the rest of the year. But he said that stimulus package, headlined as an $800 billion initiative spread over two or more years, in fact equated to just $300 billion for this year. That, Feldstein said, was less than half the $750 billion he estimated had been sliced out of the U.S. economy by dramatic stock market losses, home price declines, and a drop in residential construction caused by the crisis. The package is not strong enough, not targeted enough to deal with these problems, he stated. Feldstein noted that one-third of all mortgaged U.S. homes were now worth less than the value of their loans, suggesting more owners would simply walk away and the rate of foreclosures would rise, further depressing house prices and causing a spiral. It is a very dangerous situation, he said. A recovery is possible in 2010, but frankly, that is just a hope. Feldstein also warned of an impending slide in the value of the U.S. dollar after the crisis because of the massive U.S. trade deficit, a scenario that would drive up the trade-weighted value of the euro, making exports more expensive. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. It is Thursday, May the 21st, and I need to tell you that I will be away as from the end of next month for approximately 6 weeks as I go to Singapore and take up residence there. And a series of talks are in the process of being recorded to keep you occupied and entertained. If you want to call in now, you may do so on our line, our toll-free number, which is 888-873-4643. Let me repeat that once more. 888-873-4643. If you would like to email your questions, that is also a possibility and can be done by emailing me right now at rmartin@latamenv.com. Let me repeat that. With LATAMINV being Latin American Investments, LATAMINV. Once more, rmartin@latamenv.com. You can also call me direct if you have personal issues to discuss, and that can be done by calling me on my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once more, 305-579-2012. All right. Well, commercial real estate loans could generate losses of $100 billion by the end of next year at more than 900 small and mid-sized U.S. banks if the economy's woes deepen, according to an analyst by the Wall Street Journal. Such loans, which fund the construction of shopping malls, office buildings, apartment complexes, and hotels, could account for nearly half the losses at the banks analyzed by the journal, consuming capital that is an essential cushion against bad loans. Total losses at those banks could surpass $200 billion over that period, according to the journal's analysis, which utilized the same worst-case scenario the federal government used in its recent stress tests of 19 large banks. Under that scenario, more than 600 small and mid-sized banks could see their capital shrink to levels that are usually considered worrisome by federal regulators. The potential losses could exceed revenue over that period at nearly all the banks analyzed by the journal. That $200 billion is in addition to the $599 billion that the 19 stress-tested banks could face if the adverse stress test scenario comes true. Given the baseline scenario was more like a cakewalk than a stress test, it is reasonable to assume another $800 billion is going to be needed by banks. 58 banks have been seized since 2008, 33 of them this year. More are coming, and the FDIC is preparing for them. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I am now going to announce a new country where I believe it might be fun and profitable to invest. That country is Sri Lanka. It is an island off the south coast of India, and it has just ended what amounts to a 30-year civil war between two rival groups, the Tamil Tigers and the current ruling party of the Sinhalese ethnic group. I repeat the announcement from the Tamil Tiger chief 2 days ago, who said as follows: "We have decided to silence our guns. Our only regrets are for the lives lost and that we could not hold out for any longer. We can no longer bear to see the innocent blood of our people being spilled." That was the chief. I won't attempt to pronounce his name, but basically he appeared on the TamilNet website, which is the official site of the Tamil party, saying that the Sri Lanka civil war is coming to an end. The surrender brought cheers and celebrations in Colombo, which is the nation's capital, and the Sri Lankan army announced that it had freed all of the 50,000 Tamil civilians that the UN estimated were trapped within LTTE militants in the so-called safe zone, which has been the scene of massive slaughter in recent weeks. Now, here's what I have to say about this, ladies and gentlemen. This is a case, obviously, of a third world country having one of its wars. And you probably will be saying to me, "Oh, well, you know, what are you saying this to me for, given that, you know, civil wars are 10 a penny in these countries, and probably by the end of next week they'll be back at it again." I have vaguely followed this, and I must say that this surrender is nothing like the numerous failed peace agreements that have been signed over the years. It is, I think, the climax of a multi-generational war, and the surrender is probably more comparable to the surrender of the Germans and the Japanese in 1945, which ended World War II, or even the surrender of the Confederacy entering the American Civil War in 1865. I have been to Sri Lanka. It is a very, very beautiful country. It is another country which was British until 1948, until independence. 10% of the population speak English. It's the weather is perfect all year round, averaging about 85 degrees. I was there several years ago, and it was truly a remarkable place. If you like cooler weather, there are highlands in the center of the island, which do, in fact, have cooler temperatures, probably in the region of about 60 to 70 at night. And the tragedy of Sri Lanka is that, you know, they had this civil war, which in fact became sort of full scale in January of last year. The civil war itself actually began in 1976. It was very bloody, you know, dozens or even hundreds of civilians being killed on many days. And analysts, of course, are saying that this is typical of places like Lebanon and Kenya, where they see this kind of ethnic violence and expect terrorist activities to continue as they have for so many years. But this war, I think, is in the middle of an explosive climax of a generational crisis war. And, you know, it was expected that the Sinhalese would defend the Tamil Tiger rebels within a few weeks. But in fact, it seems to have happened earlier this week. As I said, I think the correct historical analogies are the collapse of Berlin in 1945 and the surrender of Japan after the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think that Sri Lanka will transform into a new non-violent society. I think it's a fabulous opportunity for any company thinking of doing business in a foreign country. The costs are absolutely at rock bottom. And I think anyone who understands where Sri Lanka is going in the next few months could have a huge competitive advantage in doing business there right now. Just to give you a little bit more detail about Sri Lanka, it's got beautiful beaches, for example. The water is warm year-round. The name Sri Lanka, which used to be called Ceylon, means resplendent isle. Its main exports are agricultural, coffee, tea, rubber. The British took it over in 1802 and stayed until 1948. It's in the Indian Ocean. It has a population of 20 million. It has a 92% degree of literacy. It has no leanings internationally. It's what they call a non-aligned state. It has no international disputes. It has a democratic parliamentary system, which it's had since 1931. It has universal health care. English is spoken by 10% of the population, including all of the professionals and the politicians, and business, which is all done in English. I think it's a wonderful place. I say I spent 2 weeks there several years ago, and the people are as friendly as any I've ever met, and I think you could have a wonderful lifestyle there, and at an absolute rock-bottom price right now. I have no idea how long that will last. I don't know whether the people are actually aware of what the country has to offer, of course, it's right next to India, and India is just a stone's throw away. The northern part of the island juts onto the southern part of India. In fact, you can actually see India from the northern tip of Sri Lanka. And so there you are. There you have it. A nice, beautiful country with willing people and friendly and a friendly environment. There we go. All right. I thought that I would like to read you a rather shocking article, and it's quite short, and it's come from the Russian newspaper Pravda. I'm sure you're familiar with Pravda. Pravda is one of the major newspapers in Russia, and it is not at all left-wing. It towed the party line when the Soviet the Soviets were in power, but it is not at all as left as it had seemed in those days. And it's a discussion of the United States, and some of you, I think, will find it very shocking and unpalatable. Others of you will probably nod in agreement, but one way or the other, I thought it might be interesting for you to know what Russian business is saying about America today. The actual article, translated from the Russian, is entitled American Capitalism Gone with a Whimper. And so here we go. Some of the English is a little rocky. It is a translation, but nevertheless, it will give you an insight into Russian ideas about the United States. It must be said that, like the breaking of a great dam, the American descent into Marxism is happening with breathtaking speed against the backdrop of a passive, hapless sheeple, people. True, the situation has been well prepared on and off for the past century, especially the past 20 years. The initial testing grounds was conducted upon our holy Russia, and a bloody test it was. But we Russians would not just roll over and give up our freedoms and our souls, no matter how much money Wall Street poured into the fists of the Marxists. Those lessons were taken and used to properly prepare the American populace for the surrender of their freedoms and souls to the whims of their elites and betters. First, the population was dumbed down through a politicized and substandard educational system based on pop culture rather than the classics. Americans know more about their favorite TGV dramas than the drama in DC that directly affects their lives. They care more for their right to choke down a McDonald's burger or a Burger King burger than for their constitutional rights. Then they turn around and lecture us about our rights and about our democracy. Pride blind the foolish. Then their faith in God was destroyed until their churches, all tens of thousands of different branches and denominations, were for the most part little more than Sunday circuses, and their televangelists and top Protestant mega preachers were more than happy to sell out their souls and flocks to be on the winning side of one pseudo-Marxist politician or another. Their flocks may complain, but when explained that they would be on the winning side, their flocks were ever so quick to reject Christ in hopes for earthly power. Even our holy Orthodox churches are scandalously liberalized in America. The final collapse has come with the election of Barack Obama. His speed in the past 3 months has been truly impressive. His spending and money printing has been a record-setting, not just in America's short history, but in the world. If this keeps up for more than another year, and there is no sign that it will not, America at best will resemble the Weimar Republic and at worst Zimbabwe. These past 2 weeks have been the most breathtaking of all. First came the announcement of a planned redesign of the American Byzantine tax system by the very thieves who used it to bankroll their thefts, losses, and swindles of hundreds of billions of dollars. These make our Russian oligarchs look little more than like ordinary street thugs in comparison. Yes, the Americans have beaten our own thieves in sheer volume. Should we congratulate them? These men, of course, are not elected panels, but made up of appointees picked from the very financial oligarchs and their henchmen who are now gorging themselves on trillions of American dollars in one bailout after another. They are also usurping the rights, duties, and powers of the American Congress, Parliament. Again, Congress has put up little more than a whimper to their masters. Then came Barack Obama's command that GM's president step down from leadership of his company. That is correct, dear reader. In the land of pure free markets, the American president now has the power, the self-given power, to fire CEOs, and we can assume other employees of private companies at will. Come hither, go dither, the centurion commands his minions. So it should be no surprise that the American president has followed this up with a bold move of declaring that he and another group of unelected chosen stooges will now redesign the entire automotive industry and will even be the guarantee of automobile policies. I am sure that if given the chance, they would happily try and redesign it for the whole world, too. Prime Minister Putin, less than 2 months ago, warned Obama and UK's Blair not to follow the path to Marxism. It only leads to disaster. Apparently, even though we suffered 70 years of this Western-sponsored horror show, we know nothing as foolish, drunken Russians. So let our wise Anglo-Saxon fools find out the folly of their own pride. Again, the American public has taken this with barely a whimper, but a free man whimper. So should it be any surprise to discover that the democratically controlled Congress of America is working on passing a new regulation that would give the American Treasury Department the power to set fair maximum salaries, evaluate performance, and control how private companies give out pay rises and bonuses? Senator Barney Franks, a social pervert, basking in his homosexuality, of course, amongst the modern enlightened American societal norm, as well as that of the general West. Homosexuality is not only looked down upon as a life choice, but is often praised as a virtue. And his Marxist enlightenment has led this effort. He stresses that this only affects companies that receive government monies, but it is retroactive and taken to a logical extreme. This would include any company or industry that has ever received a tax break or incentive. The Russian owners of American companies and industries should look thoughtfully at this and the option of closing their facilities down and fleeing the land of the red as fast as possible. In other words, divest while there is still value left. The proud American will go down into his slavery without a fight, beating his chest and proclaiming to the world how free he really is. The world will only snicker. Well, that rather powerful and overwhelming screed came from the pen of a Stanislav Mishin and appears on his blog Matt Rodina. I don't know whether that's in English or in Russian. It's M-A-T space R-O-D-I-N-A. Interesting quite unlike anything one would have expected to read as little as 15 years ago, or let's be a little bit more generous and say 20 years ago. I certainly wouldn't have read it 20 years ago, but maybe after the fall of the Soviet Union, people started up and started to speak much more fervently than before. But just a window into what some of the foreigners are saying about life as we know it in the country. So anyway, Peter Marciano just comes onto the email system here with an email saying, "Hi Richard, would Sri Lanka be a place that one could consider emigrating to? All the best, Peter." Yes, it would, Peter, definitely. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not, kidding, and I haven't taken leave of my senses here. It really is a very, very beautiful country, and the workforce is known to be very compliant and very willing. And depending on what you are looking for, I think it would be a fabulous place to go. I sincerely believe that the civil war is over, and I think that this gives opportunities where there will not be many for a long time to come once people understand the advantages of this place. A number of Europeans have already emigrated there in the past. I suppose it has been a little difficult during the Civil War, although it really didn't affect the average person who sort of kept out of trouble. But now that the war is over, I think you'll find a lot of people will look at Sri Lanka as a very interesting hotbed of potential productive activity. So I would definitely be in favor. Yep, absolutely. All right. I had an email, while we're still on the subject of emails, I had an email from, I just want to check there's no anonymous request here, Harold Hollister. Gee, I'm sure glad that they are using fiat money, otherwise we would have to back it up with something tangible. The only thing that's tangible now is the debt and interest on the debt that will come due in the future. Yes, indeed, you have a point there, Harold. And in fact, we've talked about, at the very least, how in about 5 years, Social Security itself will have to be funded out of current takings. There simply won't be any money left. And as I pointed out, Social Security, when set against Bernie Madoff, makes Madoff look like a small-town crook. There's very little that one can say about these things which has any degree of sunlight or optimism attached, but the debt situation clearly is going to be the death of us all. No question about that. Okay, Michael Perdek came in saying, hi, Richard. What is the Fed going to do when everyone's employment runs out? I heard a complaint at Home Depot this morning from an elderly woman about her daughter. The daughter with 25 years employment at L'Oreal Cosmetics got laid off. She has no pension or 401k. In fact, neither does the woman working at Home Depot. Will the Fed give help for them? Mike. Mike, I think I'm afraid to have to tell you the answer is no. I mean, this printing isn't going to go on. I'm hearing unmistakable signs that the government is not going to bail anybody else out, that we are really at the end of that line. And my feeling, frankly, is that we are simply going to have to take the consequences of this. I mean, the government is going to have to settle back and say, look, it's quite clear. The dollar is already falling, which it is as we speak. The falling is really quite hard. We know what the result's going to be. This is not just a few people on internet radio that are propounding, the dangers and the hazards of printing money. It's quite clear what's going to happen, and we cannot risk that in the United States. You know, had it been possible to risk it in the past, it would have been done in the past. And I always remind people that the only reason that the Weimar Republic printed money in the way they did was to cock a snoop at the Allied powers and their reparations to basically tell them, we're not going to pay you. And so, you can call and holler and basically make as much noise as you like, but it's not going to work because we're not going to do anything about it. And so that was kind of a deliberate effort to inflate the currency. I don't think America will dare go down that route. I really don't. It comes down to that in the end, whether America will actually dare to risk the massive hyperinflation inherent in printing money and bailing everybody out. And my contention is that they will not. I watch very carefully the views and opinions given to these various bailouts, and it is not positive. The people are not in favor of this, and the government will stop this. I am quite convinced that we are almost at an end of these bailouts. The public is not in favor. already back in September, when the first bailout was put forward, it was voted down by Congress. It actually didn't make it. It didn't phase Henry Paulson. He just presented it again and told them they had to vote for it, basically, and then, of course, they did. But there was an outpouring of emails and faxes and telephone calls to the Congress people and to the senators, begging them not to do this. So I don't think it's going to last. That's my feeling. I don't think that the kind of problem that people talk about is really going to materialize. That's just me. I could be totally wrong about it. I've been wrong about things before, and I sure will be wrong about things in the future. Byron MC wrote in an email saying, Richard, what is the next move for the Treasury Department now that China will get its way with a new world currency? Well, it remains to be seen whether it will get its way with a new world currency. I mean, it's one ever more important player for sure, but there are plenty of other people that do have a say in that as well. I think that the next move, and this brings me back to what I just said, is that the government is going to have to become much more disciplined in monetary affairs, and this may very well spell the end of the tenure of Ben Bernanke when his term of office comes up for reappointment or otherwise by the president. And I don't think that either he or Geithner are competent to take care of the situation, and I think they both might go in the course of the next few months. That's my feeling. But America will definitely, I think, come around and realize that even at the expense of the short-term pain of the population, they're going to have to stop this printing if they have a hope of remaining a force to contend with in the years to come. So the Treasury Department, I think, will not print money, much more money at this point. And I think that they will call in some of the money that they have printed. And the flip side of that, of course, will be that unemployment will shoot up. People will simply not be able to tolerate the situation economically. And interest rates will rise. Today, I noticed that the bond market is very sharply lower, meaning that long-term interest rates are much higher today than they were yesterday. And I think that's going to be the case. I think there will be an overwhelming sale of United States government assets over the next few months, and this will bring interest rates very, very high. And that's what's going to push the market down, I think, the stock market. Okay. Right. Well, now, I have for you something which I thought would be interesting, because I am getting a lot of mail about conspiracy theories and the like, and I did feel that I would like to address this a little bit more, and as luck would have it, I received, or rather, I came across an article in Scientific American, which explains why people believe in these crazy conspiracy theories that I try so hard to dispute. And there appears to be a strong psychological component here, which I thought, for those of you who, forgive me, but are partial to the whys and wherefores of these conspiracy theories, I thought you might like to hear this, because it is, I think, probably an explanation as to why normal, otherwise ordinary, very sound-minded people seem to wither away when they're confronted with fantastic ideas about why things are. I think it might be useful to study this in a little detail. So anyway, basically, this is from the Scientific American. It's an article about why people believe in invisible agents controlling the world, by Michael Shermer. It's called A Skeptic's Take on Souls, Spirits, Ghosts, Gods, Demons, Angels, Aliens, and Other Invisible Powers That Be. And it reads as follows. Souls, spirits, ghosts, gods, demons, angels, aliens, intelligent designers, government conspirators, and all manner of invisible agents with power and intention are believed to haunt our world and control our lives. Why? The answer has two parts, starting with the concept of patternicity, which I defined in my December 2008 column as the human tendency to find meaningful patterns in meaningless noise. Consider the face on Mars, the Virgin Mary on a grilled cheese sandwich, satanic messages in rock music. Of course, some patterns are real. Finding predictive patterns in changing weather, fruiting trees, migrating prey animals, and hungry predators was central to the survival of Paleolithic hominids. The problem is that we didn't evolve a baloney detection device in our brains to discriminate between true and false patterns. So we make two types of errors. A type 1 error, or false positive, is believing a pattern is real when it is not. A type 2 error, or false negative, is not believing a pattern is real when it is. If you believe that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator when it is just the wind, a type 1 error, you are more likely to survive than if you believe that the rustle in the grass is just the wind when it is a dangerous predator, a type 2 error. Because the cost of making a type 1 error is less than the cost of making a type 2 error, and because there is no time for careful deliberation between patternicities in the split-second world of predator-prey interactions, natural selection would have favored those animals most likely to assume that all patterns are real. But we do something other animals do not do. As large-brained hominids with a developed cortex and a theory of mind, the capacity to be aware of such mental states as desires and intentions in both ourselves and others, we infer agency behind the patterns we observe in a practice I call agenticity, the tendency to believe that the world is controlled by invisible intentional agents. We believe that these intentional agents control the world, sometimes invisibly from the top down, as opposed to bottom up, causal randomness. Together, patternicity and agenticity form the cognitive basis of shamanism, paganism, animism, polytheism, monotheism, and all modes of old and new age spiritualisms. Agenticity carries us far beyond the spirit world. The intelligent designer is said to be an invisible agent who created life from the top down. Aliens are often portrayed as powerful beings coming down from on high to warn us of our impending self-destruction. Conspiracy theories predictably include hidden agents at work behind the scenes, puppet masters pulling political and economic strings as we dance to the tune of the Bilderbergers, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, or the Illuminati. Even the belief that government can impose top-down measures to rescue the economy is a form of agenticity, with President Barack Obama being touted as the one with almost messianic powers who will save us. There is now substantial evidence from cognitive neuroscience that humans readily find patterns and impart agency to them, well documented in the new book Supersense, published by Harper One in 2009, by University of Bristol psychologist Bruce Hood. Examples. Children believe that the servant can think and follows them around. Because of such belief, they often add smiley faces on sketched suns. Adults typically refuse to wear a mass murderer's sweater, believing that evil is a supernatural force that imparts its negative agency to the wearer, and alternatively, that donning Mr. Rogers' cardigan will make you a better person. A third of all transplant patients believe that the donor's personality is transplanted with the organ. Genital-shaped foods, bananas and oysters, are often believed to enhance sexual potency. Subjects watching geometric shapes with eye spots interacting on a computer screen conclude that they represent agents with moral intentions. Many highly educated and intelligent individuals experience a powerful sense that there are patterns, forces, energies, and entities operating in the world, Hood explains. More important, such experiences are not substantiated by a body of reliable evidence, which is why they are supernatural and unscientific. The inclination or sense that they may be real is our super sense. We are natural-born supernaturalists. So there you go. Very interesting, I should say. Worth a thought or two. All right, a little bit more mail here. One from Anonymous. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, when you send an email to me, please put the word anonymous at the beginning of your email, not the end, because I normally just read them out. And if I see the word anonymous at the bottom of the email, it may be too late. Well, Anonymous, I saw it. It's only two lines long, so it wasn't that difficult. And I will respect your anonymity and simply read the email. And here goes. Where is the safest place to deposit money if the government goes bankrupt? Well, good question. Unfortunately, it's pretty much the horse before the cart on this one, Mr. Anonymous. By the time the government's bankrupt, it's too late to put your money anywhere because you've lost it all. Personally, I think that when it seems quite clear that the government is losing control, never mind going bankrupt, really that becomes the time to place money in other currencies. And I think that at that point, you are probably looking at hyperinflation. So even if you do buy real estate at that point, it really won't matter that much because the price will tend to keep pace with the inflation, as is generally the case. And if those of you who've ever spent any time in Latin America or other third world countries will know that up until recently, at any rate, real estate has always been quoted in the dollar just because of the bankruptcy of governments, the lack of control that they have over their economies. And so people have tended to quote real estate in terms of dollars. And where the dollar is illegal currency or it is illegal to actually trade in dollars, then it is simply a question of translating the dollar amount into the local currency. But I think we're away from that, a ways from that yet, Anonymous. I don't think you really need to worry that the government is going to go bankrupt. You know, governments in the end are much more inclined to study their own motivations long before they come to the motivations of their electorate. And it is in no one's interest to go bankrupt if you are in the government. And the same applies to the Federal Reserve, which is another reason why I think that the Fed will not print money randomly because it would be the shortcut to voting themselves out of a job. So not going to happen, not in the near term at any rate. All right. I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about how we stack up in terms of whether we really are in a Great Depression, another Great Depression, or not. And the only way that we can really do that is by studying the actual Great Depression of the 1930s to see whether there are any similarities. And as I always say, do be very careful not to assume that this is similar or even identical in any respect, because it certainly isn't. And I think, frankly, anybody who invokes the words Great Depression and then starts to compare our situation with that period realizes very quickly that this is much, much worse than the Great Depression. So it's probably not a good thing to talk about the Great Depression, because it really, once compared with that period, concentrates the mind on how much worse it really is. The specter of the Great Depression obviously haunts us today. There is no definition, obviously, of what constitutes a depression as opposed to simply a recession. Many economists use the rule of thumb of unemployment as greater than 10% for several years, which seems to be very exaggerated for me, because by that time you're probably coming out of the depression. Harvard's Robert Barrow defines it as a 10% or more decline in per person economic output or consumption. In their 2007 book, Timothy Kehoe and Edward Prescott of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve define it as real GDP per working person that is at least 20% below its growth trend, with at least a 15% decline within the first decade and growth remaining below trend for at least a decade. And based on their criteria, Kehoe and Prescott find that numerous depressions have actually occurred over the past century, including New Zealand and Switzerland from the 1970s to 2000, Latin American countries in the 1980s, and Japan and Finland in the 1990s. They say that by the basic yardsticks of a depression, such as unemployment levels, then the U.S., the U.K., and many other major economies are not in a depression. The U.S. rate of 8.5% in March is below the 10% threshold, and at this stage, into the unknown, the decline in job losses is far less severe than it was in the 1930s. But that, of course, is if you believe the U3 figures. If you believe the U6 figures, then we most certainly are well into a depression. And, of course, I believe the U6 figures, which talk about a 16 to 19% rate of unemployment currently. Now, empirical data for others, people, show that a worldwide depression has actually started. Economics professors Barry Eichengreen and Kevin O'Rourke claim that if the comparison is with global metrics rather than just American industrial production, exports and stock market valuations are all as bad, if not, than in the 29-30 period. According to the World Bank, global industrial production declined at a 20% annual rate in the fourth quarter of 2008. Rich Miller of Bloomberg says the symptoms point to depression, and I quote, "As in the Great Depression, world trade is collapsing, wealth is evaporating, and the banking system is broken. Deflation is a growing threat as companies slash production, pay, and prices. And leaders worldwide are having difficulty making headway in halting self-perpetuating decline." Well, while it's always obviously necessary to understand economic statistics, wondering whether we are in a depression or not is actually not all that useful. And as I said, searching for parallels with the Great Depression is not very enlightening either. It seems that there are competing versions of which prior downturn most resembles today, and some, as I do, believe that the 1873 depression is much closer to our model than the 1929 one. The 1907 panic was just that, it was a panic. And there is ample evidence to suppose that had the Federal Reserve been in power in 1907, it was 5 years away from power actually at that time, the 1907 panic would have turned into a depression itself. So please understand that similarities and differences don't really reveal anything about the underlying dynamics or the likely trajectory of any economic environment. It's much more useful to try to understand today's crisis in all its detail. And as you all know, the global slowdown was immediately triggered by the pricking of the housing bubble in the U.S., with the subprime mortgages being securitized and sold to investors in a wide range of financial institutions. Then they got marked down. And then, of course, the contagion spread. And in a globally connected world, there is reason to suppose that the Florida foreclosures ultimately resulted in the bank failures in Iceland. But, you know, the weakness of most accounts of the credit crisis is they treat the problems of the financial sphere as isolated from the workings of the real economy. And there was a recently published collection of essays on the crisis edited by Michael Lewis, in which all of the contributors focused on the financial arena. There was Paul Krugman in the new edition of The Return of Depression Economics, writing with a multitude of factors suggestive of other periods is now operating globally. And I quote, "A bursting real estate bubble comparable to what happened in Japan at the end of the 1980s, a wave of bank runs comparable to those of the early 1930s, a liquidity trap in the United States, again reminiscent of Japan, and most recently a disruption of international capital flows and a wave of currency crises, all too reminiscent of what happened to Asia in the late 1990s. End of quote. Well, again, you know, there is absolutely no attempt anywhere among these people to relate the emergence of these financial developments to the real economy, important as they are. Obviously, it's important not to make too hard a distinction between the financial and real economies. You know, we actually only have one economy, but it is much more fruitful if we can understand how these two spheres interact today. So, let's have a quick look at the emergence of the recent crisis here and see if we can make some head or tail of it. As the post-war boom ended, the major economies encountered significant problems of stagnant profitability in productive industries. Now, these problems were not fundamentally addressed by the recessions of the 70s, 80s, or 90s, and they remain to this day. And to give you just a couple of examples of the holdover of unprofitable businesses that have all come together, as it were, in the giant meltdown, you've got General Motors and Chrysler. As the economy grows, obviously credit and the financial sphere grow along with it. But there is a trend in the major economies for this sphere to grow at a faster pace than the real economy. And since the 1987 stock market crash, the trend was for stagnancy in production, which I'm afraid we're all only too well aware of, leading to surplus capital, which obviously resulted in even more extensive expansion of credit and development of finance as an income-generating area. In other words, finance which was unaccompanied by a corresponding increase in production and manufacturing. And that, of course, explains the market and housing bubbles and the proliferation of financial instruments. Now, I think it would be true to say that there was a turning point at the 1980s, at the end of the Cold War, because this lessened international tensions and weakened labor movements. In the global arena, there was a greater export of capital and goods from the developed countries, and there was the expansion of production in the emerging markets, which we didn't perhaps notice at that time, but which certainly made itself felt in the late 90s and early 2000s when China popped up unexpectedly on the international stage. And of course, to a lesser extent, so did India. Now, also at the end of the Cold War, you had an easing of tensions, which gave the market system much more room to maneuver without the need for destructive cleansing recessions. And this allowed capitalism to survive without traditional boom-bust cycles, otherwise known as the Great Moderation, and what was also known as the SAD, or Stable, Anemic, and Durable period. You know, many have welcomed the fact that it appears that recessions in recent years have become milder and less frequent. But the downside was that the reason for that was that growth, the corresponding growth that would have led to such recessions, was muted, if not entirely absent. And another self-imposed constraint, by the way, was the green measures, the environmental measures that we've all come to know and love, which have restricted expansion. There's no question that that has happened. And it's happening even today. And, you know, with global warming, whether or not it exists, it's causing a tremendous breaking of the productive machine as people have to respect the new strictures placed on production through the requirements of of the current wave of environmental concerns. Then came, you know, the wide expansion of credit, which included debt-fueled consumption, And that was clearly unsustainable. And that was what brought me to my own personal realization years ago that this whole thing was unsustainable. And I looked like a genius. I was not a genius. I was simply a person who took an independent view that massive and mindless expansion of credit could only lead to a bust. And you can take that down and put it into your profile for life in the next degree, ladies and gentlemen, when you come back, you know, formulated as an elephant or a pigeon or whatever it may be. Just remember to tell the humanoids that surround you that the current expansion of credit is going to lead to trouble. As I said before, we know that the current crisis was precipitated by the U.S. subprime crisis, which, of course, had domino effects across finance and into other sectors. But the trouble is that the problems in the productive sphere in the major economies continue today with absolutely no sign of an end. And that's one of the things which, to me, separates out the depression from today's environment. Because in the 1930s, however bad things got, and they really didn't get very bad for very long before they started getting better again prior to their getting worse yet again. But if you actually look to see in the Great Depression what was going on in the basic economy, it was very clear that those who were positioned to benefit from any kind of upturn had industries which were very viable to be able to create that upturn, such as the automotive industry, the electricity based on electricity, such as air conditioning. The entertainment industry was in its youth. Radio and, of course, television had yet to come, but there was the movie industry. We can just go on and on. And, the reality was that even the military was in its infancy, in its industrial infancy. And when people really understood what was happening in Europe and how the world was moving inexorably to war, there was a case for ramping up the military industry, which never really benefits society or the economy, but it does give employment, it does give the kind of works push which people are so desperately trying to achieve today by building bridges to nowhere and repairing roads and so thus giving so-called employment to people. We don't have today in the world the same degree of potential that we had in the 1930s, which actually makes the current depression so much grimmer and blacker than it was then. The deleveraging effect from the credit crisis hasn't yet fully played out, and of course is likely to be much more destructive, in particular the fallout from this severe asset-based recession will curb both key drivers of previous 10 to 15 years of economic activity and bank lending and financial activity and consumer spending, leaving yet more question marks over the future sources of growth. Obviously, what I've told you is requires a lot more analysis and elaboration. Unfortunately, the rescue or bailout measures, as I've said so often, and I say every single time I can on every show, they are not going to achieve anything. There are no ready mechanisms for the restructuring of capital and the restoration of profitability. It's very, very grim. I have no positive things to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, in this regard. All right, well, Steve came in with a little email here saying, Richard, he sounds like me only in Russian. Fantastic rant, could not have said it better. Otto, that was the guy, the Russian guy from Pravda. Well, thank you for that, Steve. Ladies and gentlemen, time to leave again. It is the weekend, and I am Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful one, and I will be back on Monday at 1. Take care. See you then. Bye.